commemorating Sexual Assault Awareness Month here on the First Coast. Good Monday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Melissa Ross. Hope you had a great holiday weekend out there. We are always live at 9. Also, make sure to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Just ahead, April is here. It's also marked as Sexual Assault Awareness Month. We'll tell you what's being done in this city and across the country about that issue. You can get on the line now at 549-2937. Then later, it's also Public Art Week in this city. Why, that's an increasing emphasis here in Northeast Florida. Plus, Culpepper on tonight's NCAA basketball championship. Will it be Michigan or Villanova? All of that and more ahead this morning. But first this hour, well, critics of President Trump thought he was maybe getting a jump start on April Fool's Day leading into the weekend when he issued a proclamation highlighting Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The president, of course, has been accused of sexual assault or misconduct by nearly two dozen women. But the presidential proclamation noted that sex crimes remain tragically common in our society and offenders too often evade accountability. Again, no irony in that proclamation whatsoever. April has been designated Sexual Assault Awareness Month ever since 2001. However, back in 2010, President Obama issued a proclamation from the White House about it, and President Trump has continued in that tradition. Now, there has been plenty of mockery, of course, about the proclamation on social media. Still, though, on a more serious note, across the country, organizations are doing what they can to raise awareness and bring assistance to those who've been targeted by sexual assault and misconduct. Here in this area, the Women's Center of Jacksonville is a critical resource. Teresa Miles, executive director of that center, and board member Lisa Everly are here now with more about Sexual Assault Awareness Month. Ladies, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Good morning.
Melissa.
Thanks for having us.
What are your thoughts about this presidential proclamation and your questions about Sexual Assault Awareness Month? Get on the line now at 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online, send your emails to First Coast Connect at wjct.org. Tweets to @MelissaInJax. And we welcome your comments on Facebook as well. Teresa Miles, in a moment, we'll talk all about what you're doing in the city. But first, I have to ask you your reaction to this presidential proclamation about Sexual Assault Awareness Month. The president has been accused by nearly two dozen women of sexual assault or misconduct. He's also, over the last few weeks, faced explosive claims from a porn star and a former Playboy playmate. So this climate of sexual assault and misconduct is one that is attached to him in a negative way. Mm-hmm. How does this impact your efforts to raise awareness when the president of the United States is, let's say, compromised on this issue? Mm-hmm. He is a moral leader. He's a political leader. This has complicated this issue in America in ways that we have not seen before.
Well, certainly, Melissa, I think that as a nation, we shouldn't necessarily look to our politicians as our role models. I think our role models should be in our homes, in our schools, in our communities. And I think that the issue coming to a highlight with the president is bringing more notoriety to the subject. And to me, that's going to be a positive opportunity for us. The more people who talk about it, the less it stays in the closet, the less shame is there for survivors. So as they say, any type of publicity is good publicity. So right now we will take the conversation and we will use it to our advantage.
You can turn this to your advantage when you talk about sexual assault. Of course, this is April, the month where we talk about this. Lisa Everly, here in Florida alone, one in six women have been raped. One in three have survived some form of sexual violence. One in six men have been sexually abused, too. It's a wide-ranging problem.
Well, and we do realize that the reporting is a fraction of the actual occurrence of all of these things. So we realize we're just looking at the tip of the iceberg and that the problem is even more pervasive than we realize. But the good news is, as Teresa mentioned, with all of this heightened awareness of individuals being brought forward as being sexual harassers, it has given women their voices. And we are hearing more from women who are calling our hotline, who perhaps have been holding back for 20 to 30 years in talking about what happened to them. So it's given a lot of people their voices, and that is a very positive thing that's come out of all of this.
Right. Despite all the pain, that the Me Too movement, the Time's Up movement, have really open the floodgates when it comes to our society reckoning with this. And so that is really affecting your operations. Teresa, the Women's Center of Jacksonville is the only certified rape crisis center for Duval, Baker, and Nassau counties. You do everything from forensic exams and evidence collection to psychological counseling. Hundreds of women a year benefit from your services. And as we are learning, you're getting more women coming to you.
We are. After the Me Too movement launched, we had a 53% increase in the calls to our hotline. Just in that
50%.
Yes, 53% following that.
And when? Like a few months ago?
Yeah, October, November.
Wow.
A huge increase. December, a huge increase in women coming forward. Last year, we served 339 women just for sexual assault forensic exams. And be mindful of that being a window of time, because we only have up to 120 hours to gather that evidence. So that, you know, is just a very small portion of the people that we actually have served. And if you look at 1 in 3 are actually reported, 2 out of 3 are not. We're probably looking at well over 1,000 individuals in the Jacksonville area.
Whether it's Me Too, the President, Sexual Assault Awareness Month, we want your calls and thoughts at 549-2937. Give us a call. You said there's a window of time?
Yes.
Tell me more about that.
When you look at a forensic exam, your goal is to gather as much evidence as possible to aid in the prosecution of the person who's done this, of the perpetrator. So when you look at evidence itself, 72 hours is the national standard, but we have seen best practices at 120 hours to still be able to get some evidence, cervical evidence, that would indicate a sexual assault, or at least the evidence would be used towards the full picture for a sexual assault. So.
Okay, and you have had a critical shortage of space to do this important work, but you're making some progress on that. Tell us about your new Rape Crisis Safe Center.
Absolutely, very exciting. And we call it a SAFE Center as an acronym for Sexual Assault Forensic Exams, and we will be actually doing a ribbon cutting on April 24th of this month. We launched a community initiative in October 10th of 2017 with a $3 million campaign. And we are already about a third of the way there. Lisa, do you want to mention that?
Actually, closer to halfway there, which is really exciting. The community has wrapped their arms around this initiative. And that was our hope. You know, we weren't looking, well, of course, it would be wonderful to get three large donations. But what we were really seeking is a lot of donations from a lot of people in the community. And that's exactly where we are now. People are responding in a wonderful way to helping us create this safe center.
And with this center, not only will you be, it sounds like not only will you be helping people that have been abused or assaulted, you'll be providing evidence to police and prosecutors so that they can bring more of the perpetrators to justice, correct?
Absolutely. Tremendous support from JSO and the state attorney. Both Melissa Nelson and Mike Williams are extremely supportive of this effort and have been involved, as have you, on our host committee. So a lot of wonderful things moving in that direction. And actually today we are launching a connection that we have had with Amazon and Target, where if individuals would like to donate, similar to registering for a new home or a baby shower, they can go to our website, click on the donate link, and that'll take you to where you can purchase things that are necessary for our new center. Everything from toilet paper to furniture, everybody can help.
Interesting. Now, that's an innovative fundraising method. Is that all the rage now in the nonprofit world? I like that. You know, when you talk about the Me Too movement, it was just extraordinary to see this outpouring. And it was mostly women. But men have been sexually assaulted and abused, too.
Absolutely.
1 in 6 in this country. I don't think people realize that.
Yeah.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that side of it?
Well, I think men are so hesitant to come forward because of the image of men in our culture. And so to admit not only to having been the survivor of sexual assault, but that element of weakness that it portrays, or being bothered by it. my profession was in human resources, and it was rare that a man would come forward with a complaint of sexual harassment because it simply wasn't a macho thing. So to be violated this way sexually is something that I'm sure is more difficult for men just because it hasn't been a topic of conversation. Women have gained some momentum in speaking out, and it's going to take men speaking out for other men to find their voices. But we are pleased that at the Women's Center of Jacksonville, we are seeing men coming forward. And
you have some men coming in for services.
We serve men and women. We serve all genders.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And so for men in particular, it's hard to come forward, but it's not easy for women. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit why the effects of this can be so long-lasting emotionally for people that have survived this?
I think it's because of the perception of shame. What could I have done differently? Was I wearing something that was provocative? Was I drinking alcohol? Did I put myself in a position for this to happen? Those are all the things that people carry inside them. And unfortunately, they often get reinforced by a rape culture where people who even love you may say, did you really get in that car? Why did you get in that car? And it's very hard for people who love you to understand that just because you got in that car didn't mean you should be raped.
Can you explain a little more fully for all of our listeners what rape culture is?
It really is where there continues to be a perception that a survivor of rape somehow brought that upon themselves by letting
the inaccurate perception,
by letting their guard down, by drinking alcohol, by being in the wrong place at the wrong time. And the truth is, Melissa, if I walk down the street naked, no one has the right to touch me. Yeah. It's about consent. If you don't consent for someone to touch you, then they have violated you.
Well, and I think there's also been a history of women not being believed, women and children not being believed. They come forward. We saw that with the gymnastics issue.
And hundreds of victims.
Exactly.
That weren't believed,
And that's what we're trying to change. Is last year, one of the things that the head of our rape recovery team said during the proclamation was, we see you, we hear you, and we believe you. And that's what everyone needs to hear.
Yeah. I mean, I was listening on Morning Edition just this morning before you both came in about the latest in all of the legal actions against Bill Cosby, who's been accused of raping and drugging dozens of women. And, you know, dozens of women had to come forward before they were believed. So in that sense, a woman is like 1/56th of a person. When Kevin Spacey was first accused, he was accused by another man, the actor Anthony Rapp, who was known for starring in Rent and a lot of other productions. It took one male accuser, one, for Kevin Spacey to face accountability. A lot of other people came forward after Anthony Rapp, but Anthony Rapp was instantly believed in a way that women traditionally in the past have not.
Right.
But after this movement, Teresa, do you think that's changing?
It is changing. It is absolutely changing. And our hope is that it's not changing out of fear, but it's changing about a sustained value system that we are no longer going to allow this to occur. If men are changing the way they treat women just out of fear for how other people would think or fear of losing their jobs, that's not a sustainable change. Change doesn't happen and continue because you're afraid. It happens and continues because you believe it's the right thing to do and the values are there. Mm. So we really have to move our culture toward a value of we treat women with respect and dignity. We treat all people with respect and dignity.
And again, I have to come back to this question. You're saying that President Trump's situation with this issue is an opportunity for you, not a hindrance. How is it helpful to the culture societally if you have a leader who's been accused by so many women of sexual assault or misconduct? And if, as you're saying, women should be believed.
Absolutely.
Clearly, a majority of Americans either didn't believe these women or just didn't think it was important.
Right.
So what about that?
I can't say that it's helpful to society to have somebody who is a leader of our free nation accused of these things by any means, but what has happened is the conversation has heightened, and it's given us an opportunity to speak more publicly about it because everyone is. I mean, we've always spoken about it, but now at a national level, you have members of the House and the Senate and people who are talking about it now, and our hope is they start to hold themselves accountable as well.
And even in the Senate, the women of the Senate are now forcing changes mm-hmm. in the way sexual assault and misconduct allegations are handled in the Senate.
Absolutely.
On Capitol Hill, because a number of lawmakers of both parties have been accused. But the process to deal with that is antiquated and not adequate and,
Certainly not moving as quickly as Hollywood.
It's not working well. So even in Congress, this is an issue.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is an issue everywhere. And I think it's been interesting through this Me Too movement to see the heightened awareness of sexual harassment in the workplace. And even progressive organizations have been suffering from leadership thinking they're above the law. This has been around for over 30 years. And why there's confusion over what sexual harassment is today is appalling to me, because it has been well-defined since the 1980s. So I think what this is all doing is increasing awareness. And what we're trying to do is bring men into the equation. Because once men speak on this topic and men put peer pressure on men to behave differently,
that's when the change
comes. That's when change occurs.
So how can that be done in a way that makes guys feel comfortable about talking about this? Because as you said, a lot of men are afraid to say one word about this mm-hmm. for fear of saying the wrong thing. There's also peer pressure for men not to call out other men, even though they know other men are probably not behaving in the way they should be. So how do you create that climate for men to step into this?
Well, I'd like to shout out Jacksonville University, because they are engaging in our bystander safety program. And what that is all of the faculty and all of the students attending Jacksonville University are going through the Women's Center Green Dots bystander safety program, which means we are committed to creating a safe space for all students and faculty and staff on the JU campus. So it has become a dialogue that the males are engaging enthusiastically as well as the females on campus. And I think that intervention at that age is significant. We need to get into the grade schools, into the high schools, talk about healthy relationships, and get that shift in our culture from that young age.
You know, the last time you were on this show, Teresa Miles, you made a comment about this, that there are all these cultural things that we've been raised with that contribute to this that people might not even connect. For example, when you're a little kid and you go to some family gathering and you're told to go kiss grandma or the aunt or uncle, or let them kiss and hug you. Mm-hmm. And sometimes kids don't want to do that,
right.
You know, and I was told to do that, and I did it, mm-hmm. even though I didn't always want to, mm-hmm. just because sometimes kids are uncomfortable with that.
Mm-hmm.
What you're saying is that you shouldn't force children into physical contact they don't want.
Absolutely.
That's a big concept shift, I think, for a lot of Americans.
Yes. It's consent.
Even though that's seen as non-sexual contact.
Right. Especially in the South, Melissa. In the South, we all tend to do that with, you know, your aunts
yeah.
and your uncles. And I think that, you know, giving other alternatives for kids. I know my cousin, her kids high five. They don't have to hug anybody. And she tells them, you know, do you want to high five your aunt? You know, and that has become their kind of way of, you know, doing that. And if they don't want to high five, they don't high five.
But can you explain why those types of family things can lead to outcomes later that might not be so good? A lot of people listening might say, well, that's not a big deal.
Yeah, yeah. Really what it does internally is it says to a child that I am supposed to do something with my body that makes me uncomfortable because an adult has told me to do so. And as children, you want to be compliant and you want to follow rules. And if an adult tells you those things, that is something that you're imprinting in a child's mind. And they don't necessarily know how to differentiate that between a good adult and a bad adult. We have to teach children early that their body is their own and they should never have to do things, you know, because somebody else wants to feel comfortable, because somebody else wants a hug. Mm-hmm. You know, certainly there are things like with a physician and things that you teach your child how to address those issues prior to having that happen. But mm-hmm. we've got to give children consent over their own body so they carry that into adulthood.
Let's talk about the workplace for a minute, too. Lisa Everly, you mentioned your career was in human resources.
Yes.
Now, you're no longer in human resources, but are you?
I do a little bit of consulting.
A little bit.
Yeah.
How would you say workplaces are still struggling with this? Because after decades of dealing with this issue in the workplace, I don't think office culture is, I mean, there's been some progress, but clearly not enough when you saw this flood of women and some men coming forward saying, this happened to me in the workplace and my company didn't handle it right. I was penalized rather than the accuser. That type of thing.
Well, I'm puzzled by it as well. Because, again,
or penalized rather than the perpetrator, I should say.
Right, right. And which has always been. And there are whistleblower rules as well. So there's no reason for this to be happening. You know, I think it's one of those things that organizations had a focus on in the 90s when it was new. And then I'm afraid what happened is over the course of the next couple of decades, it became less of an issue of concern because there were other priorities in the workplace. And I think we've come back to that now, is recognizing that, you know, we didn't pay attention to it and it did get out of hand again. And now we have to go back to the basics. You know, what is sexual harassment? What is appropriate workplace behavior? What can I do if I feel threatened or uncomfortable by something that someone does that mm-hmm. I work with, or someone in a position of power? Mm-hmm. And it's always about power. And so we're just getting back to the fundamentals, I think, that we've gotten away from over the last 20 years.
Okay, so it is Sexual Assault Awareness Month. A number of things happening all through the month, Teresa, to commemorate this. What are some of the highlights?
Well, one of them is this Wednesday, April 4th, we are going to have a proclamation. And you talk about a community of involvement. This is an opportunity for our community to come together. We have the mayor, the state attorney, the sheriff. We have so many wonderful people coming out to read and understand this proclamation that says, as a city, we are not going to embrace a rape culture and that we are going to believe survivors who say that sexual assault has occurred. So that's going to be at 10 a.m. at City Hall this Wednesday. And, of course, we have a whole list of events that will be posted on our website as well. Everything from a kickball tournament this Saturday, which is a tremendous amount of fun. I think FDLE has a team, Sheriff's Office, State Attorney's Office, the Women's Center, and I believe we even have a media team out there. So we are going to have a wonderful time, and there is trophies involved. So that gets competition going.
Very nice. Go to the Women's Center of Jacksonville website for more. Executive Director Teresa Miles, Board Member Lisa Everly, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us, Melissa.
Thank you, Melissa.
Much more still ahead later. College basketball's champ is crowned tonight. Cole Pepper will have a look at Michigan versus Villanova. Also, a look at Public Art Week around town. But up next, a conversation with the late civil rights legend Stetson Kennedy.
Community Hospice and Palliative Care. Are you a caregiver? You're not alone. A day of info and inspiration open to the public at Caregiver Expo with special guest Donovan Darius, Saturday, April 14th from 9 to 3 at Everbank Field. Register at mycaregiverconnection.org.
More than 500,000 Jewish Americans fought for their country during World War II. Get a sneak peek at the remarkable and little-known story of how these brave servicemen and women struggled against fascism as WJCT, in partnership with the Jacksonville Jewish Center, hosts a preview of segments from the new documentary, G.I. Jews, Jewish Americans in World War II, and a panel discussion with local veterans, Tuesday, April 10th at 7 p.m. To RSVP for this free event and complete details, log on to wjct.org/events. Sponsored in part by River Garden Senior Services.
Down in flames.
Almost every sports fan has had a moment where you're like, I cannot believe my own emotions right now.
The next thing I know, I'm being hugged by this woman, just slinging me left and right, left and right.
Bottom of a pile. I couldn't breathe. It was like, oh my God.
What is it about a game that makes it
more than a game?
We wonder on the next Radio Lab.
Sunday at noon on 89.9 WJCT.
Electro Lounge is now on Spotify. On the road or at home, take us wherever you go. Just search WJCT 89.9 on Spotify, where the Electro Lounge is always on.
PBS NewsHour weekend anchor Hari Srinivasan will be here in Jacksonville at the WJCT studios on Thursday, April 19th. Hari Srinivasan has emerged as one of the country's most respected broadcast journalists. Join him for an in-depth discussion, beginning with a VIP reception from 6 p.m. to 7 p.m., followed by a discussion at 7. For more information and to purchase tickets, go to wjct.org/events.
Welcome back. Well, a new book is out with a comprehensive look at the life of the late civil rights legend and folklorist Stetson Kennedy. Peggy Bulger is the author of Stetson Kennedy, Applied Folklore and Cultural Advocacy. And she joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
And you are the state's first folklorist, so this comes naturally for you. You knew Stetson Kennedy for decades, and what a treasure, a new book about his incredible life.
Yes, actually, I came to Florida in 1976 and met Stetson soon after. He became a mentor and a friend. But his life was absolutely amazing. And as most people say, he's probably the most amazing person you've never heard of.
Exactly. He, of course, grew up and lived his whole life here in Northeast Florida. He was famous for infiltrating the Ku Klux Klan and writing about it as far back as the 1940s. Mm-hmm. He wrote many books, but he was also a folklorist. And so you look at his life through that prism, too.
Yes, actually, what the book is about is how folklore is so powerful. And most people, we don't even realize how much of our lives are caught up in our own folklore and what we believe. And our beliefs become how we live our lives. So Stetson realized that early on. He was a self-taught folklorist from an early age. And how he actually infiltrated the Ku Klux Klan and got their charter revoked in Georgia was by using their folklore against them.
How did he do it?
Well, what he would do, he was infiltrating the Klan, of course, and he knew the power of naming and the power of secrecy in terms of secret societies, like any society, like a fraternity, a sorority, whatever. We all have our secrets. Even the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts have folklore. So he infiltrated the Klan and was working with Drew Pearson, who was a reporter and a columnist. He was also working with
The New York Times or Washington Post?
He was he did a thing called the Washington Post. It was the Washington merry-go-round.
That's right.
And he was an amazing guy who, you know, was working with Stetson. Stetson had infiltrated the Klan in Stone Mountain, Georgia. And he would get the secret passwords, the secret handshakes, the secret, you know, there were certain words that you said if you saw somebody on the street and you wanted to figure out if they were a Klan member. Those secrets were told.
Yeah, it published all over the country.
Right.
Right.
And then also he was a consultant to the Superman radio show, which was being produced, of course, nationally back before television. This is in the 40s. So everyone was listening to Superman, and they had a whole series of shows called Superman Battles the Fiery Cross and Superman and the Fiery Cross. And it was about Superman battling the forces of hate and evil and it's a lesson that needs to be learned in every generation.
Now, you've done extensive interviews and research, all of his writings, to put together this book, with help from the Florida Historical Society. So this is a way, for people that didn't know about the impact of this man and how he was based right here in our area while he was alive, this is a way for people to get a window into his life now.
Absolutely. And, you know, some of the things when I interviewed him about being part of he was the head of the Federal Writers Project here, the folklore unit. He was Zora Neale Hurston's boss. People don't know that. And also he was a great friend of Woody Guthrie, who lived on his land for about 18 months. So.
Down in St. John's County.
St. John's County, right on Old St. Augustine Road, on 50 acres. It's now a county park. St. John's County owns the property, and it's called Beluthahatchee,
which means a place of peace and harmony.
Mm-hmm. And when he passed away, of course, there was a wonderful memorial service for him at Beulah Ahatchie. Gosh, it's been a couple of years now.
Mm-hmm. He passed away in 2011 at the age of 94. And so, yes, they had a wonderful service for him. But Beulah Ahatchie now is open on Sundays. You can Google it and get their, their schedule of events, because they do have folk singing and different educational programs.
Definitely worth checking out. Uh-huh. And pick up Peggy's new book. It's Stetson Kennedy, Applied Folklore and Cultural Advocacy. Peggy Bulger, thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Back in a moment.
Many people in Jacksonville never come in contact with those outside their core communities. WJCT is embarking on a journey called Beyond the Core to start a citywide conversation about what unites the people who call Duval County home and what makes our smaller communities unique. We might have an upcoming Beyond the Core listening event in your neighborhood. Check WJCTnews.org to find out.
On Ask Me Another, our very important puzzlers often teach us things.
You can ask me this. Does espresso have more caffeine than regular coffee?
Okay.
Less.
And some facts are more useful than others.
Chambage is a little fizzier than Camel. It's like Camel with a splash of champagne.
Join me, Ophir Eisenberg, for NPR's Hour of Puzzles, Word Games, and Trivia.
Saturday at 11 on 89.9 WJCT, your community, your world.
Take a drive with us into the Blues Horizon every Monday and Wednesday night at 11. The best in classic and modern blues. As part of WJCT's After Hours. Every Monday and Wednesday night at 11 on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world, your music.
I don't want no woman telling me what to do.
Welcome back. Well, this week marks Public Art Week in the city of Jacksonville, a week of showing off the growing local collection of public art around town and highlighting its importance, too. This year's theme is building a better community. So how does public art help us do that? Here with more, we welcome Christy Holacek. She's Director of Art in Public Places, and Patrick Fisher, Community Collaboration Manager, both with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Christy, Patrick, thanks for being with us.
Good morning, and thank you for having us.
Good morning.
Okay, Christy, you're Director of Art in Public Places. So where there people see a sculpture, a mural on a wall, or other public art all around the community, you're really involved in the effort to get as much of that as we can. Why is it important?
Well, I think for sure you cannot understand the importance of public art. We see it not only in kind of the visual outcome of integrating public art throughout the city, but we also see it as such a community builder as well as a community experience from start to finish. It's also how we visualize our city's identity. There's a lot of stories that are untold, and this is a super opportunity to bring those to light.
Mm-hmm. In downtown Jacksonville, especially, Patrick, the urban core in recent years, there's been an explosion in public art. It's slowly transforming the landscape of downtown.
Absolutely. And we're actually seeing it expand beyond just the urban core. Mm-hmm. If you look at the partners that are involved in this week's programming, we have representation on the Lower East Side, the Northwest Side, all the way down to St. Augustine. So I think that what occurred and is occurring in the urban core and downtown has served as a catalyst to encourage and motivate other communities, other neighborhoods to also take on similar projects. So between what we are doing at the Cultural Council through APP, but also all the private initiatives that are occurring, it's a really remarkable time in Jacksonville.
Can you explain a little more fully, Christy, how public art attracts other things, including it's a form of economic development?
It's absolutely a form of economic development. We even have the opportunity to work with local vendors and local artists, as well as partnering with some amazing businesses in the city. And it is very clear that a public art project can be simply like a museum without walls.
Mm, that's a good way to put it.
It really is. And it's all about accessibility. So if you can create an accessible environment where people really want to be in that space and engaged, it'll bring people to the place.
Now, there's a lot of examples we could point to, but what are some really interesting pieces of public art that have gone up recently that you could highlight that people, when they hear you say, oh yes, I've seen that. What comes to mind?
I think some of the most notable forms would probably be what Art Republic has done in the last 2 years, just because they are such grand scale
pieces. Huge murals.
Massive. And you know, several of those pieces you can see from I-95, you can see from I-10. So to get that representation and accessibility even from the interstate is really remarkable. From an APP collection, I know that what we did last year through DIA Urban Arts Project Phase 1 and the Skyway columns, just how that changed foot traffic on those streets where they're present, because now there's something more engaging to look at.
These columns that hold up the Skyway, they're painted now.
Yes. Very colorful paintings. And the artists that did those paintings are actually going to be present during Public Art Week. Cecilia is going to be painting two additional columns up at Hemming Park. But then Andrew and Cecilia are also going to be involved in a session on Thursday evening at MoCA that is intended for individuals that are interested in the public art process and becoming public artists themselves.
Tell us a little more about what you just mentioned, the Downtown Urban Arts Project, in particular what's known as the Elbow District. That's a downtown strip of bars and night spots.
Yes, the Downtown Investment Authority is working with the Cultural Council for essentially a four-year, three-phased urban development program through public art. And we've identified three areas in the downtown urban core that essentially have the sites that we can focus on to bring in public art that is not only functional, but it's meaningful and it's site specific. We'll be moving into the third phase after we complete phase two, which will probably take about a year in total because it's a very big community process. Mm-hmm. But we worked with DIA to essentially build a program that we can model in the community at large.
There's also a project going on at UNF Center for Urban Education and Policy. It's a student project highlighting the civil rights movement in our area, and that's going to be unveiled soon. It's the Hope and History Mural Project.
Yeah, so it's been an ongoing project where they actually developed a curriculum for the students, and they've interacted with historians and civil rights leaders, Rodney Hurst, and they actually went to sites where many of these incidences occurred, like Axe Handle Saturday, and they learned directly from individuals that were present. The students are now working with their art teacher and artists of Art Region to develop a interpretation of their learned experiences, and that will be on the Eastside Brotherhood building. And that's going to actually start in a couple weeks, but they're going to have the dedication ceremony during Public Art Week. So Rudy Jamison, who is with UNF, and Rodney Hurst and several other individuals will be present to talk more about that experience during that dedication ceremony.
So that's one example. What else is going to be happening around town for Public Art Week?
You know, it's really just wonderful to see so many partners involved this year, and so many of them are actually not arts organizations. When we programmed this year, we were really looking to involve ourselves with organizations that are addressing other issues and are finding ways that they can use the arts to assist in their mission and their message. So we have Rue Art in the Park every day doing participatory events where you can help make mosaics on the planters in Charlie's Cafe. But then we also have Groundwork Jacksonville doing another mosaic project, which will be the first grant-funded public art project along the S line. We have the Hope and History Mural Project, as you mentioned. We have the Dream Big Mural Project, which is another participatory event, and that will have the dedication ceremony on Saturday, and as well as an opportunity for families to come out and be involved in the actual creative process. But then we also have a lot of walking tours scheduled throughout the week to learn more about public art.
People need to go to the Cultural Council's website for that. And there's a call to artists coming up. What's that all about, Christy?
Well, as Patrick mentioned, the Skyway columns and the projects that are located in the first phase of the DIA have been completed. And now we're moving on, like I mentioned before, to phase two. And with that comes a call to artists. And we put that out and we're seeking qualifications from artists who can bring public art and authenticity to a program in the course. So that call will go out. And as he mentioned during the Thursday panel discussion, there will also be an opportunity for a question and answer, as well as walking to the Elbow District and looking at upcoming sites.
And last but not least, it sounds as though both of you feel that this art is just as important as the art people go and look at in a museum. People might in the past have discounted public art or maybe seen it as less than, but you don't think that?
Not at all. And I think that what's so necessary about public art is the multiple points of access. The fact that you can access it no matter your economic level, or no matter the time of day that you are out and about. So I think just the sheer accessibility and the creation of a sense of place and community identity is really important with public art.
So much happening around town. It is Public Art Week in Jacksonville, and it's expanding this year. You have some community partners, too. So did you want to mention them quickly?
Oh, I would love to. We have Rue Art. We have Friends of Hemming, Jacksonville Public Library, Phoenix Arts District, Jacksonville University, the Davis School of Business, Sculpture Walk Jacksonville, Springfield Preservation and Revitalization Council, Art Republic, 927 Events, Compassionate St. Augustine.
That's a lot of partners.
WJCT.
Oh, yes.
And, probably another 10 or so more. And we're so, so appreciative of all their efforts.
Well, thank you both for bringing this to us. Again, it's Public Art Week in Jacksonville. If you check out the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville's website, you can be part of a walking tour this week and a whole lot more. Christy Holacek is Director of Art in Public Places. Patrick Fisher, Community and Collaboration Manager. They're both with the Cultural Council of Greater Jacksonville. Have a very artistic week. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us.
In a moment, college basketball's national champ will be crowned tonight. Will it be Michigan or Villanova? I'm still sad about Loyola not making it. Dang. Culpepper will have a look at all of that and the rest of the weekend sports right after this. Stay with us.
Just stuff on the floor. community hospice, and palliative care. Are you a caregiver? You're not alone. A day of info and inspiration open to the public at Caregiver Expo with special guest Donovan Darius, Saturday, April 14th from 9 to 3 at Everbank Field. Register at mycaregiverconnection.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Tara Hogan Personal Injury and Wrongful Death Law Firm. Distracted driving is deadly, and it's not just teen drivers. Adults do it too, and there are millions more adults than teens. Arrive alive. Stop distracted driving. More at waynehogan.law.
For decades, Tom Peters has been telling anyone who will listen to put people first.
The fabulous news for all of us is there are no experts. They're winging it in the corporate boardrooms, and all of us are winging it with our careers.
In the 80s, this business guru was all about the search for excellence. Now he's ready to talk about the excellence dividend. Tom Peters, next time on 1A.
Weekdays at 11 on 89.9 WJCT.
On the next Fresh Air, the astonishing story of the Siamese twins Chang and Ang, who were brought to America in 1829, exploited and displayed as freaks. Eventually, they took charge of their own career, became rich, married two sisters, and fathered 21 children. We talk with Yunta Huang about his new book, Inseparable. Join us.
Weekdays at noon on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
Craig Pittman, author of the book Oh Florida, will be giving a talk Sunday, April 8th at 2 p.m. at the Orange County Regional History Center. I'm Ben Brotmarkle, and coming up on Florida Frontiers, the weekly radio magazine of the Florida Historical Society, we'll talk with Craig Pittman. We'll discuss the Florida Historical Society annual meeting and symposium May 17th through 19th in Sarasota. That and much more on Florida Frontiers, Monday evening at 6:30 on 89.9 WJCT.
Welcome back. Finally, this hour, college basketball's national champion will be crowned tonight.
I'm a pepper, he's a pepper, she's a pepper, we're a pepper. Wouldn't you like to be a pepper too?
It's Michigan versus Villanova. Who are you betting on? Cole Pepper is here with his thoughts. Hey, Cole.
Good morning, Melissa. Yeah, both schools have won championships in the past. Michigan in 1989, Villanova in 85, and then again 2 years ago. So these are two schools who have championship pedigrees in their background. And it's interesting that after all the upsets and all the Cinderella stories this year in the tournament, we come down to a number one seed and a number three seed. Not a incomprehensible matchup in the national championship. That being said, Michigan has become the first team in the history of the tournament to never play a team seeded higher than a five seed to get to the national championship game. Huh. They had a lot of roadblocks knocked out of their way on their way to the national championship game. Michigan ended the Cinderella run of Loyola Chicago in the semifinals. Sister Jean just came so close. But
I know, it's so sad.
She became a Final Four legend and also has a bobblehead of her now,
isn't
which is
amazing?
Pretty fantastic.
I love that.
While Villanova set a Final Four record for three-pointers made in beating Kansas, Nova is the favorite. If the Wildcats do win it, it would be two championships in 3 years. And in the last 40 years, only two other teams have had a run like that. Those were both back-to-back wins with Duke and Florida both winning back-to-back titles. So this would be pretty historic if Villanova would turn that trick and get the win tonight, which I think they will, by the way. I think it's going to be too much for Michigan. I think Villanova will raise the trophy at the end of the evening.
The unimpeachable Kevin Merchart here in this building, I think his brackets were the only ones to kind of make it to the end.
Oh, is that right? Well, no yes. surprise that he has Michigan there.
Oh, but, yeah. He's a Michigan native, yeah. Michigander, as they say. And he's talking to me right now. He got 3 out of 4, he just told me.
Just not Loyola Chicago, I'm guessing. Yep. And which almost nobody had, but pretty impressive. There were a lot of busted brackets around the nation, for sure.
Yeah. All right. And including yours, I think you said.
I had Villanova and Kansas on the one side. Okay. I did not have the other two in the Final Four.
That's not bad. All right. So yesterday was April Fool's Day. A lot of pranks going on around town, including one from the Jaguars.
Yeah, they tweeted out a supposed leaked announcement and photo of the new uniform. It was not real. They will unveil the new uniforms to the public on April the 19th at the team's annual State of the Franchise announcement. I talked with both Shad Khan and Tom Coughlin last week at the NFL annual meeting in Orlando about the uniform. Khan basically said, hey, I took my first crack at it. It was edgy and very unpopular. So we're going back to a more traditional look. Coughlin likes, and this will give you an idea of what it may look like. Coughlin said that, hey, we're getting close to having players in the Hall of Fame from the original era, and he wants that connection with today's team. So the uniforms are going to look very reminiscent of the uniforms that the Jaguars wore in the heyday when Coughlin was the head coach. They're also on that date, April the 19th, talk about the Shipyards project and the proposed Lot J fan entertainment zone at the State of the Franchise address. Always a lot of information coming out of that address from the Jaguars.
Okay, so we'll keep our eyes on that because certainly a lot of people wanting to hear what the next phase is for that.
No doubt.
Development.
And the state of the franchises in the past where we've heard things like about the amphitheater and indoor practice facility, other stadium renovations, giant video boards and swimming pools, that sort of thing. So it's equal football business as well as sort of development business around the Jaguars where we get that information.
It's Masters Week in golf. Yesterday, Cole says, was the final chance to earn a spot at Augusta National.
Yeah, the Houston Open. Ian Poulter won in a playoff. A week earlier, Poulter thought he had earned a spot in the Masters during the World Match Play Championships. Then he was told he actually had to win one more match. He lost that and needed to win this week to earn a spot back at Augusta.
No, last week was painful. And, you know, to come here this week, I was tired. I was frustrated on Thursday. I didn't play my best stuff. And I packed my bags, obviously, to leave on Friday. And, you know, a mental switch. I said to James today, you know what, let's just go play golf.
I mean, a pretty amazing turnaround. And now he's in Georgia to play at Augusta National this week. Florida baseball continues to roll along. The defending national champions have won six straight games against top 10 teams, including a three-game sweep of Vanderbilt over the weekend. Florida's ranked second in the nation.
Second in the nation.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
And Vandy's eighth, so the Gators certainly look like a team that could go back to the College World Series again this year.
Okay, now let's talk a little more minor league baseball with our own Jacksonville Jumbo Shrimp. You're going over there to check out not just the game, but the menu.
Yeah, I mean, listen. These are the kinds of sacrifices I will make for my industry.
For your art.
For my art.
I make a sacrifice for my art of sports.
I would make an awful starving artist, by the way. The Jumbo Shrimp will be showcasing some of the new food offerings for the season tomorrow.
There better be meat if you're going over there.
Yeah, I don't think the tofu burger is probably gonna be the first thing I'm going to dive into.
Not really.
I mean, great for other people. Doesn't work for me. But the Shrimp start the season Thursday on the road. The home opener is a week from Wednesday against Mobile.
Last but not least, the U.S. Women's National Team plays Mexico at the newly named TIAA Bank Field in Jacksonville Thursday.
Thursday, it's a friendly. Jill Ellis, the head coach, was in a couple of weeks ago. The first thing she said was, look at those video boards. They're
really
going to love to see the highlights streaming across those. Of course, the third time that the U.S. women's team has played here in Jacksonville, and Jacksonville has really become one of the favorite cities for U.S. soccer to visit. They really like the facilities. They like the way that the city embraces them, and I expect we'll see more in the future opportunities for the U.S. men's and women's national teams to showcase their wares here in Jacksonville.
Never a shortage of sports talk around town. Always good to have Cole on Mondays. Follow him at Cole Pepper on Twitter. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Melissa.
All right, that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board, our theme composed by the Jacksonville Symphony's Pyotr Chepchik. 1A's up next, and if you're listening to our rebroadcast tonight, stay tuned for music. I'm Melissa Ross, and this is First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT-FM Jacksonville, your community, your world. We'll be right back here again at 9 a.m. tomorrow. Have a great day.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.